May it please the Court, my name is Joseph J. Rhodes, and my colleague and friend Kevin Marciano, Esquire, of the law firm of Cherry, Feiger, and Marciano in Media, Pennsylvania, was admitted to the bar of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania in 1992. Since then, Mr. Marciano has been a member in good standing at the bar of that court. I know Mr. Marciano to be a reputable and competent attorney, and Mr. Marciano met the requirements for admission and was admitted pro hoc vice before the Superior Court of the State of Delaware, and has met the requirements for admission and was admitted pro hoc vice to the bar of this honorable court. It is with utmost respect to the members of this court that I introduce Mr. Marciano and thank the court for allowing Mr. Marciano to appear today to argue the case currently before the court.
Welcome, Mr. Marciano. Thank you, Mr. Rhodes.
May it please the court. It's an honor and a privilege to argue here. Thank you for granting me permission. Under Rule 16D, I have reserved 5 minutes of rebuttal. This court should rule in the appellant's favor for four reasons. One is that this incident or accident was foreseeable, that the property owner defendant undertook a duty. In this case, he placed wheel stops in part of the parking lot, but not the entire parking lot. And under the Restatement 323, which this court has adopted and the entire state of Delaware has adopted, is that he must do so like a reasonable man would, and he has not done so. He put him in two spots and not throughout the entire parking lot. Also, there's genuine issues of material fact that exist in this case. When shouldn't the appellate win in this case? If the striking vehicle was going 70 or 80 miles an hour, clearly the appellant wouldn't be successful. Or if a bulldozer came through the front of the pizzeria and struck my client, clearly the appellant wouldn't be successful. In the state of Delaware, Restatement 344 has been adopted in which...
Well, why is that? Why wouldn't your client be successful?
Because that's not foreseeable. As a matter of law. You bring up a good point because there's case law. Actually, this court decided less than 8 weeks ago in the Hazel versus DSI case in which there was some condensation on the floor. And Justice Jacobs dropped a footnote, 6 and 8, citing the Jones case and stated, the existence or non-existence of a dangerous condition must depend on the facts and circumstances of each case and is generally a question of fact for the jury to determine, except in very clear cases. The case with the bulldozer, the case with a car going 80 or 100 miles an hour, that is not a very clear case. This is not a very clear case. The vehicle was only going 16.5 miles an hour. The curb was only 2.5 inches or 2 3/4 inches. A bicycle could have gone over that curb.
Mr. Marciano, I take it you rely heavily on the fact that the defendant put wheel stops at least in two places on a different building but on the same general lot. Is that right?
We rely on it, yes.
Okay. And the argument that I understood you to be making was that that from that fact, we can apply or should apply the doctrine that, even if there was no pre-existing duty, by putting those two wheel stops in those two different locations, the defendant undertook a duty.
That's correct.
Isn't the fact that there were two wheel stops put in the different locations simply evidentiary, going toward the question of whether or not that a vehicle could jump the curb and therefore it was foreseeable, in this case?
No. It is a question for the jury. This property owner undertook a duty to
That's what I'm asking. Doesn't the fact that the same owner chose to put wheel stops in a different place, in different locations, mean that he was able to foresee, at least for that adjoining building, precisely the kind of accident that took place here?
That's one of the arguments that we're making.
That's an evidentiary argument, correct?
It's a jury question. It's a jury that has to decide whether or not it was reasonable that he should have put wheel stops throughout the entire parking lot when he chose to do so. And under the restatement,
suppose that same defendant had not put the wheel stops there, didn't put wheel stops anywhere, and simply relied on the absence of any law, that is, of any ordinance or statute that required anything more than what he actually did here.
That's a much tougher case.
You would
not
say
not fatal, but much tougher.
Not fatal. Why not?
Not fatal. Because a property owner has a duty under the restatement to do what's reasonable. And in some of the cases that this court has relied upon, for example, the Pfeiffer versus Parcell case in 2007, this court held that a passenger grabbing a steering wheel is foreseeable. If you compare a passenger grabbing a steering wheel compared to a car going through a storefront, you have to weigh, are those foreseeable? Those are jury questions.
But it would be a much more uphill fight for a plaintiff in the case where there were no wheel stops at all.
I agree.
Than in this case.
I agree. It would be more uphill.
So doesn't the rule that you're asking us to adopt penalize the person who's trying to make his or her building safer?
That's what the restatement does. The restatement says that if you undertake a duty, you need to do it reasonably, and he didn't do it reasonably.
Well, Mr. Marciano, help me see the connection between putting real wheel stops so someone doesn't bring their car too close to a pole, which would occur on a regular basis. If you just pull into the parking lot, a lot of people, you know, go too far into their garage, or people that park next to the wall of a building get too close to the wall. And there would be a lot of reasons to have wheel stops so you don't bump the pole or bump the garage that have nothing to do with the car being out of control, even at 16 miles an hour. What's the correlation between trying to keep people from bumping the adjoining poles and foreseeing the possibility a car would go right through the front of the building?
The restatement sets forth that if a property owner undertakes to protect persons or things, that if someone is injured, that property owner is responsible. So it doesn't matter in this case that he's merely trying to protect the property, because let's take it one step further. Let's say a vehicle struck the posts that he was trying to protect. Under the appellee's argument, if the post came knocking down and a roof fell on a person, under the appellee's argument, then the property owner wouldn't be responsible. And clearly under the restatement, the property owner is responsible, irrespective of trying to protect property or things.
I see. So I guess the factual predicate in my question is different than your answer. I'm assuming that he put the wheel stops there because he didn't want someone to bump the post at 2 miles an hour or 3 miles an hour, whatever you're going, just before you stop your vehicle. And you're suggesting that the wheel stops were there because someone could whip into the parking space and hit the post and knock the building down, so that the property owner was really concerned about people driving at a faster speed.
Again, the restatement says even if we believe this property owner, if he was only trying to protect the post and didn't care about anyone getting injured, because he's undertook the duty to protect his own property, the restatement sets forth that he now is responsible for any injury that results in undertaking that duty to set forth wheel stops in only two spots, and needs to do what is reasonable and needs to do what he knew or should have known.
So the restatement creates a positive economic disincentive on the part of the property owner to do anything more than the law allows.
Well, this property owner, if he had done what was reasonable, then he wouldn't expose himself to this liability.
That's putting the rabbit in the hat, Mr. Marciano. The question is, what is reasonable? Why isn't it reasonable for a property owner to basically put whatever safeguards or not put whatever safeguards are not required? That is to live up to the letter of law and do nothing more. You know, absent any other external reason for foreseeing that this might happen.
The evidence shows that this property owner, and he testified that he didn't look at one book, didn't consult one person, didn't try and find out what he needed to do, what was reasonable. What he did is he closed his eyes.
Suppose he did do all those things.
That's not the case here,
though.
Suppose
he did.
Then it would be a stronger argument that he did what was reasonable. This property owner cannot argue that he did something that was reasonable because he didn't avail himself of educating himself what a reasonable person.
So the property owner that does legal research, finds out there are no requirements and does nothing, is in a protected position, but the property owner that doesn't do that but ends up doing the same bottom line thing is not protected?
That's not this case. There were legal requirements. There was the curb should have been higher. Under the Sussex County Code, there was a code that required that there be a protective device, and that just wasn't here. And what he did is he undertook only to put it in a part of the parking lot, not the entire parking lot.
In the answering brief, your opponent takes the position that that code provision didn't apply to private property. Have you determined that the code did apply to private property?
That's a question for the jury. My expert...
Well, no, you ought to be able to read the code and decide that.
Well, it's our position that it applies. Otherwise, we wouldn't have included it in our argument. And I have an expert that so states that this code applies to this property. And of note, the defendant doesn't have any, or excuse me, the appellee doesn't have any expert to dispute that. So it's undisputed at this point from the record that an expert has so stated that that Sussex County Code applies to residential property.
Why is an expert necessary to tell us what the law is? The code either does or doesn't apply.
It's our position that it applies.
Well, maybe you can articulate for me then the difference between your position that allows you to reach that conclusion as a matter of law and the appellee's position, which comes to a different conclusion reading the very same code. Where does he have it wrong and where do you have it right and why?
There's no specifics as to whether or not it applies to what type of property. It's silent to what type of property it applies to. That's actually why we employed an expert, because we didn't know, reading it on his face, and an expert who deals with these type of special areas to educate the jury, a particular area of specialty, to educate the jury and to educate us why it applies.
You think under Delaware law, a Delaware trial judge is going to let an expert opine on the law to the jury?
Experts are able to interpret code and how it's applied to a particular piece of property. With regard to foreseeability, this court, I mentioned the Pfeiffer case, also in a number of other cases, talked about the standard of foreseeability. In the Rogers versus Delaware State case, a 2006 decision by this court, a student that was shot at an off-campus, the court found that it was foreseeable. In addition, in the Peterson case, a patron was assaulted, found that that was foreseeable. And the Rogers case, and I quote, stated, questions of foreseeability are jury questions, and the unique characteristics of the particular assault should not be considered over facts. That should be applied here. This is a car accident. It shouldn't be looking at the particular facts that the person went through a wall and struck my client. Just in that case, no matter how the assault occurred, whether or not the person was beaten or whether or not they were hit with a stick or some other way, do not focus on unique circumstances, but just the fact in that case, as you found, was an assault, but in this case, it's a motor vehicle accident.
But the Superior Court cited the majority, purported majority rule that curb jumping cases are, as a matter of law, that type of circumstance is not foreseeable because apparently it's so rare. Is that what the rationale of those cases is?
When you say the majority, I think there's a better way to look at. You take all the cases that appear to be on the appellant's side and all the cases that appear to be on the appellee's side, because those cases span 40 or 50 years. And just like the law, just like property owners, just like society, we need to change with the times. A good benchmark is to look 10 years back to 1998. Why? Well, because vehicles are faster, stronger, and more powerful. There's SUVs that can go over these types of things put in properties to protect. And if you go back and look at the cases over the last 10 years, there's really only two cases on each side for the appellant and for the appellee. In the Sotomayor case, it's a Georgia case, Sotomayor versus Tama. In that case, a car came across, went over a curb, went on a...
Is it your point that a Model A could not jump a curb? Is that what you're...
It would be much more difficult to jump a curb, absolutely.
But it can.
Depending on the speed. Okay. There's an expert report, Dr. Kilareski, an engineer, that states that because Mrs. Bussard, the driver, was only going 16.5 miles an hour, she would have not gotten over the wheel stop. In fact, if she had been going 35 miles an hour, she would never have gotten over the wheel stop. That's the barrier, 35 miles an hour. With regard to other cases in other jurisdictions, there are only four, two for each side. In the Sotomayor case, in that case, the distinction was found that there was an intervening fact. In that case, ironically, the driver of that vehicle had only purchased the vehicle a month before of the little girl's father had sold it to her. And she fled, and that court found that there was an intervening criminal act. With regard to the other case, the Mississippi case, Heard versus Interest, in that case, it was car jumping, but in that case, there was a 9-year-old that drove the vehicle because her father was too drunk to drive. That was a residential property, not a commercial property here. With regard to the cases in favor of the appellate, the Marshall versus Burger King case, that's a 2006 Illinois case. In that case, that Supreme Court found that the question of fact is, does a defendant's conduct, is it inconsistent with building industry and code? That's precisely the argument here that we want to be able to present to a jury and allow a jury to decide. Also, a 1998 California case, Robeson versus Six Flags. In that case, a car went out of control and hit picnickers. And in that case, they talked about foreseeability, and again, not to focus on the facts, the unique facts and circumstances, but look at it as a car accident or in the Peterson case as an assault.
Can we go back for a moment? You mentioned something about building codes and regulations, and that's what you wanted to put before the jury. Can you elaborate on that? I'm not sure what you meant.
There is a state standard, Delaware DOT, that appellate submits that requires at the minimum a 4-inch curb. In this case, there's only a 2 3/4-inch curb. That should be before the jury whether or not it applies. Also, I had made reference to a Sussex County code that requires that there should be some type of protective device, curb, fence, or something else to protect cars from going on where a patron or a pedestrian would walk on a sidewalk.
And were those arguments offered below?
Yes, they were, and were included in plaintiff appellant's expert report as being applicable to this case.
And help me out here. How did the court, the Superior Court, deal with those arguments?
Superior Court Judge Cooch wrote that with regard to the Sussex County code, that I conceded that it didn't specifically make reference to a wheel stop, and it didn't. When I read the code, it said a protective device. And the expert in the case opined that a wheel stop is a protective device. Clearly, the curb in this case didn't provide the protection that it should.
Okay, so that's an issue we would have to decide?
The appellate believes it's an issue that a jury should have to decide.
Well, isn't it an issue we would have to decide? That is, whether the court's construction of the ordinance, if that's what you're referring to, is correct. And what about the DOT?
There's a Delaware standard plaintiff's expert, Mr. Hicks, opined that all curbs should be 4 inches. In this case, the curb was only 2 3/4 inches.
That's probably the one that calls into play whether or not that's on public or private property, correct? Because that regulation probably applies to contractors who are putting in curbing for the state of Delaware roadways.
That's an issue of fact for a jury to decide. Our expert has opined that this applies to this case.
Yes, but the judge opined that it didn't. If that expert's testimony is to go before the jury, isn't that a decision that we would have to review and reverse?
The decision whether or not a specific code or regulation applies is a jury question. Experts testify all the time whether or not certain codes or regulations.
I'm sorry, if the DelDOT specification or whatever it is specifically either specifically or reasonably can be read to apply only to public property, public highways, for example. You're saying that that's a jury question?
When the statute was read, one couldn't reasonably read whether or not it applied to public or private property. That's why an expert was employed to make that determination.
Well, the judge did determine that, though.
He did.
And
so opined.
Excuse me.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And I assume you contend wrongly decided that, correct?
I didn't hear you, sir.
I assume you contend that the judge wrongly decided that that particular Del Dot standard was inapplicable to your case.
That would be correct. I note that my time is up, and I'd like to still have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, if Justice Jacobs is satisfied you finished answering his question, okay.
Thank
you. Your time's reserved.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. It's an honor to stand before you once again. On this particular occasion, I have the pleasure of representing the appellee, Oscar and Mary Warrington. The issue in the case is fairly simple and fairly well framed, and it represents a basic analysis of tort law, as we've all learned it, and as I understand we have some newly hired clerks in the back. We talk about duty, we talk about breach, we talk about causation, and we talk about damages. And as is well known, you can't get to the jury unless, and you can't make a case unless you have an ability as a plaintiff who holds the burden of proof, or in this case the appellant, to satisfy each of the four prongs of the tort law analysis, a very basic statement, and I appreciate you granting me that. Let me go back, if I might, to just a couple of facts that were not pointed out when my colleague spoke. What we know from the circumstances that existed that day, and I don't stand up here stating facts that are in dispute. I state facts that are looked at, but admitted by all parties, and in a light most reasonable and most favorable to my opponent. We know that on the particular day in question, Ms. Bessard and a couple family members were coming out of the adjoining Chinese restaurant. She had parked her car up against the sidewalk and curbing area. She and her guests had gotten into that vehicle, had put that vehicle in reverse, and had moved back a bit from the sidewalk and curb area. Ms. Bessard then testified that she puts that car in gear, at which point that vehicle starts to rev wildly out of control. According to her testimony, and there is no dispute in the record from anybody on this point, the car then proceeds to lurch forward at a high rate of speed and out of control. There is no ability for that she senses to stop that vehicle or reduce its speed in any way, shape, or form. That vehicle then propels through the portion of the parking lot that she was able to travel upon, over the curb, over the sidewalk, into the facade of the building, through the facade of the building, into the restaurant, and only comes to rest, when it strikes the rear foundational wall of the property. And if I may, because when we were standing up before resident Judge Cooch, we had the same example for him. Imagine, if you will, a car comes through the back of this sanctified courtroom, comes into the courtroom, crashing through all of the barriers that would exist, the curb, the sidewalk, the facade of the building, and only comes to rest by the rear foundational wall. It's not an overstatement. That's what happened in this particular instance. That gets us to the question of, not of duty. I don't think there's any argument here that a landowner owes a duty to its business invitees. Respectfully, to my opponent, that is not the issue here. That is a well-known fact. However, as part of duty is the issue of foreseeability. It's a two-part analysis. Number one, is there a duty? There is a duty. A premises owner owes a duty in varying degree to business invitees, to social guests, to trespassers, and the like. The sub-question within the context of the issue and under the umbrella of duty is one of foreseeability, and that is where this case begins, and that is where this case ends. As Justice Ridgely pointed out, there are a number of cases from around this nation that have looked at this very exact issue, and I suppose we can put them under the umbrella of curb-jumping cases, if you will. The majority, the overwhelming and vast majority of states have held that this particular act is not foreseeable as a matter of law. Now,
well, your opponent suggests that those cases are outdated, that now we've got Humvees and everything else that can go over curbing and sidewalks and everything else, and therefore it's to be expected.
Well, I beg to differ that they're outdated. If you look at the dates on those cases, you'll find that they're from the mid to late 80s, and some move into the 90s. And are cars bigger now? I suppose we can argue yes or no as to whether a Toyota Prius is bigger than a Buick LeSabre from 75 that I used to drive, and we can have that debate. But really, one can look at and one can answer that question, Justice Ridgely, by looking back to the legislature. If that is correct, as my opponent urges, none of the statutes have changed, none of the ordinances have changed, none of the rules or procedures or protocols have changed with respect to buildings and curbing. And in this particular instance, let's not cast a wide shadow, let's cast a narrow shadow for what we're talking about. In Sussex County, there has been no change, as my opponent urges that there, you know, people are now driving tanks instead of bicycles. So I'm not sure that's really a well-placed argument from my opponent's point of view, because there is no statutory authority that really sides with the appellant on this point. As my appellant concedes in his briefing papers, the statutory authority or the ordinances or whatever one might look to in an attempt to establish a duty and therefore establishing foreseeability simply do not exist. If I may pick up on a point that my opponent was questioned upon, that is the point of the Del Dot standard, if you will. And in point of fact, there is a Del Dot standard, and the question is whether or not it is applicable to the particular instance that brings me before the court today. And one really only needs to look at the decision that resident Judge Cooch prepared. And I asked the court, if the court would like to indulge me, it's at multiple places in the text that was supplied, but in particular, I look at the appellee's answering appendix. This particular notation can be found as B as in boy 127, B127. And I quote, as resident Judge Cooch writes, "Likewise, plaintiff's reliance on the Del Dot standard is unpersuasive. That standard, which, quote, prescribes procedures for new highway construction and highway improvements," end quote, and it is footnoted. We clearly are not dealing with a situation of new highway construction, and we are clearly not dealing with a situation of highway improvements. As resident Judge Cooch found, and I urge this court also to do so, the Del Dot standard is nothing more than a red herring and is simply, plainly stated, inapplicable to the facts as presented before the court today.
There is one factual wrinkle in this case that at least we're told arguably removes it from the sphere of being non-foreseeable as a matter of law, and that is that in this particular case the landowner had the foresight, depending on how one looks at it, to construct two wheel stops in the places where the roof was being supported by poles that intersected with the ground. Having done that, doesn't that create at least a jury question on the issue of whether this type of accident was foreseeable in this particular case, or at least by this particular landowner?
It may, depending upon the reason this gentleman put the wheel stops in place. And for that, I cite the court to the appellant's appendix at B as in boy 78, B78, which can be found at Oscar Warrington's deposition, page 58, line 2 of the transcript. And Mr. Warrington answers that very question that Justice Jacobs, you put before me. The question to him was, why did you put the wheel stops there, or some close machination of that? And first of all, I point out to you, I think as is well known by the five justices, that the wheel stops were not placed on his property. They were placed on his parents' adjoining property. Do I find that terribly important in terms of the analysis? I really don't. But the question is, why were the wheel stops placed there to answer the issue of whether or not an event such as transpired here was foreseeable? The answer that Mr. Warrington provides is that the wheel stops were placed there because the roof was supported. That is, the roof that hung over the sidewalk area was supported by two poles. Those two poles went from the roof down to the very edge of the curbing and were placed right between the very edge of the curbing and the adjoining asphalt parking lot. Mr. Warrington was concerned that someone might bump into the support, thereby knocking it down, and God knows what might have resulted from there, whether or not the roof would have come down or not. So he thought, well, let me grab two wheel stops that he happened to find somewhere, and he put them only in that particular place for only that particular instance. If you ask him, as was asked to him by counsel, whether there were any previous incidents of, or whether he had any knowledge of any vehicles coming across the sidewalk area, whether he had any previous knowledge of a vehicle leaving the asphalt area coming into one of the establishments, or even actually bumping into one of those poles that we previously discussed, his answer is no, I never heard of anything like that. I never saw of anything like that. I never knew of anything like that. And I hope, sir, that answers the issue that you raised, which is one of foreseeability. As Judge Cooch dealt with that particular fact, and he dealt with it in much the same way as I discussed with you, one can raise that point and hope to curry some favor with the court by saying, well, now you latch on to a particular point of restatement because now you can argue that it was foreseeable to Mr. Warrington. But when you look at the facts of the case and you look at what Mr. Warrington's testimony was on the point, you could not reasonably come to the conclusion that this was in any way foreseeable by that simple act.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
That's right. Go ahead. I gather that what you're saying is that one can properly infer from Mr. Warrington's testimony that it was foreseeable that a car might run into the poles that were intersecting the ground very close to the curb. But it doesn't follow from that that same property owner would therefore have foreseen that a vehicle would overrun the curb and go much further into the property area up to the foundation, which I gather was set back from the curb for a certain distance.
You gather correctly, and the answer to your question is 100% correct. Yeah.
Help me understand the limits of foreseeability as a matter of law. What if a property owner does have prior knowledge that, say, your client sells the property and the new owner knows that there's been a curb jumping at that location, and then there happens to be another curb jumping, hypothetically, would they still be protected as a matter of law?
I don't believe so. At that point, knowledge is power, and knowledge is key. At that point, the landowner has knowledge that an event like this could occur, and I don't think that anybody can then stand up and say, well, I didn't know that, and therefore it wasn't foreseeable. You did know it, and therefore it follows form that it was foreseeable. And in point of fact, that's actually covered by the decisions, and if I can put them under the umbrella of curb jumping decisions, that's covered as one of the potential three ways that you might be able to get past a summary judgment on the issue of foreseeability. And it's covered in a lot of places, and I choose in particular to look at Judge Cooch's decision, because it's there as well. At page 7 of Judge Cooch's decision, B125 of the appellee's appendix, and if I may, that this goes on to tell us that a minority of courts have held that liability can potentially be a question of fact for the jury in curb jumping cases in three instances. Number one, where the business provided no protection whatever from encroaching vehicles. Well, we know that's not this case. Number two, where the defendants had knowledge of prior similar accidents, which, of course, is the point that you're making. And number three, where the design of the building required customers to await service by standing next to a parking lot or driveway, clearly inapplicable to this particular case. So I do grant you, sir, that if there was prior knowledge or prior events, there would be no ability to an attorney or counsel to stand up here and advocate that an issue was not foreseeable.
Why should a property owner have to have knowledge of a curb jumping at this particular location in order to make it foreseeable when it could have happened at any other restaurant location anywhere around the country? Doesn't that provide foreseeability, just the fact that this isn't the first time that a car has rammed through the front of a commercial building because the gas pedal got stuck. And even though you didn't expect it to happen at your place, you knew that those kind of accidents do occur.
I think I can answer that best by responding that, as I had previously indicated, this is an issue that's been well covered around the country. And the majority of states and the Supreme Courts of the majority of states have looked at this exact fact scenario and have held under this exact fact scenario that this issue is not foreseeable under this set of circumstances. And I go back, if I may, to what Justice Ridgely had to say, that what if this particular gentleman did have a previous episode of car jumping? Then certainly that's knowledge. He's got to do something to avoid this from happening again in some way, shape, or form. But when you look at this across the country, all of the courts really, but for one or two states, as my opponent points out, are telling us that as a matter of law, this issue is not an issue of foreseeability.
Well, can you tell the court how your client satisfied the first of the three circumstances that Judge Cooch referred to?
Absolutely. The first standard, if I may go back to it, is where the business provided, quote, no protection whatever from encroaching vehicles, end quote.
And I read your brief as saying that 2 3/4-inch curb was the protection that your client provided, and that was adequate.
That's 100% correct. If you look at what the courts talk about in terms of no protection whatever and where in limited circumstances they have allowed this particular circumstance or scenario to get to a jury, is where there was no curbing whatever.
Well, that's why I'm having difficulty relating these three circumstances as you described them when you might be liable in a curb jumping case. And you're saying the answer is provide the curb that was jumped. Clearly, that seems to be problematic. You would think in a curb jumping case, you'd start with a curb, and then there would be some additional protection beyond the curb. You understand my question?
Well, I hope in my answer I show you that I do. If I don't, please feel free. One has to sit back with a question like that and then say, as a landowner, are you responsible for overall public safety? We know from all of the cases that you look at that a landowner is not the insurer, if you will, of the entirety of public safety. So the first question you look at is say, well, did Mr. Warrington comply with the law? We know that he did. There is no statutory authority that says otherwise. And then you say, well, why is that? Why is a 2 3/4-inch curb enough? Why not have something behind the curb? Why not have a jersey barrier or something greater?
My question is really a follow-up to Justice Berger's question, which is, do we focus on the specific landowner or do we look at the phenomena that sometimes cars jump curbs? And if we conclude that sometimes cars jump curbs, then you have to factor that in when you're constructing the building. And even if you have a curb, have an additional protection. The argument we're hearing from the other side is, a curb is not enough, and this particular curb was too low anyway. Putting that debate aside, they're saying you should have had wheel stops in addition to prevent the curb from being jumped.
Well, what you'd be advocating if you were looking outside of the facts and circumstances of this particular case is a scenario that simply stated doesn't exist, and allow me to state it. You'd be looking at a scenario that, as a matter of public policy, all parking lots for all strip centers in Sussex County, Kent County, and Newcastle County, the entire state of Delaware, have to have wheel stops or some other type of greater barrier than is required by the current law to be satisfactory so far as tort law and the laws of liability is concerned. And if I may, with all due respect, I don't believe that is an accurate statement of what the law requires, nor do I believe that is as you look around, and we all drive around and can see it, that's an accurate statement of what goes on in the general public.
So then your answer to my question directly with regard to satisfying number one in the three circumstances that Judge Cooch outlined is you need to have a curb.
That's what the Sussex County Ordinance seems to tell us. And you can step back from that and say, well, why does that make sense, Silverman? Why just have a curb? And the answer is quite simple, that the curb is not there to stop vehicles, as in this particular case, from charging through the building and coming to rest with the rear foundational wall of the building. The curb is there to stop vehicles from rolling forward, as one might expect could happen. The facts of this particular case, and that's why this case perhaps was granted summary judgment, and I assert that's an issue that should be affirmed. The facts of this particular case scream out on this particular point that we're discussing. This event could never have been foreseeable to this landowner or really any other landowner who did not have prior knowledge of this kind of event occurring.
Pose some other questions with respect to the design of the parking lot and the curb and you know whether there were wheel stops or not. Why shouldn't a jury have to consider that, since we all know occasionally cars get out of control either because of the driver or because of a malfunction in the car, and we all know that you need a parking lot in relation to your establishment, whatever sort of establishment it is, that the landowner has some obligation to design a parking lot and arrange how the cars park in the parking lot or how far it is, across a grassy area or a sidewalk or whatever before a car that's out of control might actually run into the establishment, but that all of these are different parameters that overall one has to decide whether the landowner acted reasonably in the way the establishment was designed and set up and way the parking lot was set up avoid this possibility, and if the landowner was reasonable, then the fact that this was this accident occurred is an unfortunate fact, but there's no liability. On the other hand, if the landowner didn't take reasonable steps, which may not have had to be the wheel stop, it may have just been the design of the parking lot. Why shouldn't the jury hear all about that and hear about how unlikely it would be that a car would be able to go fast enough and far enough and so forth to cause damage, and then assess the reasonableness of the way it was the parking lot was set up?
The reason is because, if I may characterize your question as one in which why doesn't a jury determine whether or not a duty exists? And that seems to me to be what you're asking.
Well, no, I thought you agreed right at the outset there's a duty.
Oh, if I misspoke, I didn't mean to say that. The question of whether or not there's a duty subsumes the question of foreseeability. So whether or not there's a duty is the question of foreseeability. There is landowner liability that is black and white in the state, and there is a duty from a landowner to a business invitee. That's the situation that we have here. However, you don't run past duty and get to causation as the next prong, because you then have to answer the question of foreseeability. And as this court told us, actually it was the court sitting en banc, this very same court, with the inclusion of Vice Chancellor Noble in the case of Pfeiffer versus Parcell just about a year ago. And I quote from page 5 of the court's decision, this court has recognized that, quote, whether a duty exists is entirely a question of law, to be determined by reference to the body of statutes, rules, principles, and precedents, which make up the law, and it must be determined by the court. So I hope that you can appreciate that's my answer to the court's inquiry as to why not just let these questions roll to the jury. Because it is a judicial function to determine whether or not a duty exists, and the duty is really a two-part analysis, which has to be, and a part of that is, whether or not an event such as the one we have here is foreseeable as a matter of law.
But the cases that say there is no duty, and I'm quoting from the California case, there is no liability because such accidents are insufficiently likely as a matter of law. So what if the, when, how many more car curb jumping cases must there be before you leave the insufficiently likely to sufficiently likely?
I'm hoping that question is rhetorical, but I'm thinking it's not. With all due respect, I don't have an answer to the question. It's a question of degree, and I cannot respond to you as to how many then make it a question of foreseeability. However, I'm not going to duck your question, because the answer to me is at least one. Because if this happens again at this particular location with this landowner, how could this gentleman come back and say to a member of the judiciary that I want summary judgment in my favor because I didn't know? This was not a foreseeable event to me. Unlikely, and quite candidly, that would really lack some candor towards the tribunal. So my answer to your question is at least one, if not one. I do see that my time is up. Unless there are some additional questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before you begin, am I correct that there's a difference in the curb required by DLDOT for its roadways and Sussex County's decision of what curb size is correct for parking lots?
Sussex County doesn't indicate the height of the curb. It only indicates that some type of fence, barrier, or other protective device should exist to prevent a car from encroaching on a sidewalk.
All right, I'm incorrect factually. Let me ask you the question logically. Does it make sense to you that a curb requirement would be higher on a roadway where speeds could range from 35 to 55 miles an hour, let's say, where logically there might be curbing, as opposed to a barrier against the speeds that could be reasonably anticipated or foreseen in a parking lot adjacent to a restaurant?
It may be, but that's not the case here. The case here is you have someone that put a wheel stop that's between
No. Don't address my question. On an issue of foreseeability, is it not part and parcel of foreseeability? What is the likelihood of someone exceeding a speed of a certain amount in a parking lot as opposed to on a highway?
I'd agree with
and
that.
And what barrier would then reasonably be required to protect business invitees from any likely speed of that kind? Isn't that the kind of analysis that takes part in foreseeability?
In a vacuum, yes, but with this case, you have someone where there is foreseeability because he put the wheel stops and he knew that a car could go over the curb and strike the posts. Yeah. So now there is foreseeability.
Yeah, and where the posts were located and the post purpose was to hold up an overhang roof. So he did put wheel stops there, and they immediately faced someone else's property where there may or may not have been his control over their speed in any way. But isn't the real point that if you're looking at an issue of foreseeability as a part of duty and you consider in law and economics what's the relative cost of building a barrier that would anticipate any conceivable speed that a car could do in the year 2006, as opposed to what is likely to be the speeds of vehicles at that location where the curb was jumped, how much sense does it make for a reasonable juror to conclude that the accident that happened here under these circumstances could have been reasonably foreseeable?
It was foreseeable because he was aware of the existence of wheel stops. There's no mention of how much they cost.
He was aware of the existence of chain-link fences, of Jersey barriers, of the Berlin Wall. And all of those could have stopped a car potentially. But the point is, isn't it, what is the likelihood, the reasonably anticipated speed of a vehicle in his parking lot that was intended to come to rest adjacent to that curb? That's the real focus, isn't it? Not what might happen in the worst of all worlds, but what's the reasonable, foreseeable likelihood of a required barrier to stop the anticipated speed in a parking lot?
This woman backed her car up halfway across the parking lot, and the speed that she hit the curb was 16.5 miles an hour. 16.5 miles an hour is reasonable. That's something that a property owner should anticipate. This property owner, we're not asking for him to put up an impregnable barrier, as some of the case law suggests. What we're asking him to do is do what he's already done, but do it right.
Did you have expert testimony that said that those barriers that he, wheel stops or whatever you want to call them, that would have prevented a vehicle from bumping the poles would have stopped a car going 16 and a half miles an hour?
Not only would it have stopped it, it would have stopped a car going 35 miles an hour.
I take it the answer is yes, you did.
The answer is yes. It would stop it at 16.5 and would stop a vehicle up to 35 miles an hour.
Mr. Marciano, help me understand the facts in this record. As I understand, Mr. Silverman, he said the pole was right at the edge of the sidewalk. And if that's true, then the bumper of the car could hit the pole long before the wheels jump the sidewalk. Is that correct?
Not the way he installed it. He didn't install them properly. He didn't
Just help me understand the facts. What I want to know is if the pole was at the edge of the sidewalk, and let's assume for a moment it was, then you'd put the wheel stop several feet away from the beginning of the sidewalk, so the wheels would be stopped by the wheel stop before the bumper hit the pole that's supporting. So my question is simply, so I can understand the facts in this case, was the pole right at the edge of the sidewalk so that if the wheel stop was properly installed, it would stop the wheels before the bumper ever got to the sidewalk? Or in other words, the car would never have to jump the sidewalk to knock down this pole.
To answer your question, the way I remember the picture, and actually I looked at it yesterday, is that you are correct. The pole, we don't have to assume, the pole is right on the edge of the sidewalk. But what the restatement says is that if he undertakes to protect things or persons, that he's responsible.
No, I understand that. I just wanted to make sure I understood that on this particular property, you could knock the pole down and the wheels would never even be on the sidewalk.
But if you knock the pole down and a person was underneath it and was injured, under the appellee's argument, the property owner wouldn't be responsible.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.